Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. It's fall in California. That means that the persimmons on our tree are getting ripe, and the raccoons are going completely insane in the backyard. It's kind of mind-boggling. So, I mean, I'm looking forward in a big way to getting out of town, escaping the raccoons, and going to London to visit the Nature mothership. You know, I work in California. We have a small office here with one other Nature editor, but really no one else from the geoscience community that I work with. And really most of the intellectual activity and developments take place in London. So it's always great to go back there. I try to make it work on a couple other levels too, you know, not just going and hanging out with my buddies in Nature, but I'm going to go to a site visit at the Royal Holloway University of London out in Egham. I had initially tried to get in touch with Beth Ann Davies out there, but she's on leave right now. Fortunately, she's giving a seminar at the Geological Society down in Piccadilly, so I'm going to try to hit that up as well. And then, you know, we were there for a couple of years, 2008 to 2010, and my wife made some great friends through her job at the Hunterian Museum, which is a fantastic spot to visit if you're ever in London, kind of a museum of modern surgery. And I've stayed in touch with those people over the years. So my friend Haley and I are going to go to this fancy restaurant for free. What happened when I was in London in 2015 was I had just an appalling case of food poisoning. I let the restaurant know, and I think it was from there, but who knows. And anyway, they kindly said, look, you know, come back. It'll be on us. So now a year later, I'm going back to have that lunch with Haley, which should be good fun. I'm, you know, a little nervous, but I think it'll be okay. And then my other friends, Karina and Oliver, are going to be around on that Saturday. And Oliver and I are going to try to get out to the country to do, you know, the best thing you can do in the English countryside. Go for a walk and hit up a couple of country pubs along the way. That should be a huge amount of fun, hopefully. And otherwise, I'm still getting more involved in economics and climate. I talked to Solomon Tsang about that a while ago. I'm now going to a climate change and economy lunch seminar series up at Cal that Sol and his colleagues kindly let me attend. And that's been pretty interesting. I go there half the time. I really don't have any idea what they're saying, but I'll get the jargon eventually. Then I'm going to go to the American Economic Association meeting. It's in Chicago in January. It's not a high priority for like where any sane person would want to go in the middle of winter. But I'm going. Hopefully, I'll be able to do a couple of visits to University of Chicago and Northwestern while I'm out there as well. Then in the summertime, like long term, we're trying to work out a plan to get to the East Coast for a couple of months this summer. The plan is that we go out there and stay at my wife's family's small farmhouse in rural Maine, which would be this awesome base to go to, like a Gordon conference. There's a great meeting on sea level in New York City, another Clivar meeting. And then I have a whole slew of lab visits I'd like to do out there while I'm in the area. And you know, also our big office in the U.S. is in New York, and I've never even been to that office. It'd be good to go and check in there with folks. But today, I'm talking to Bronwyn Wake, who's the chief editor from Nature Climate Change. Bron is fantastic fun to hang out with. I spent a lot of time with her when we were both in Qingdao at this Nature Masterclass and the Clivar Open Science meeting. She took over, you know, just a few months ago when Roy Howlett left. It's been, I think, a difficult transition because of just staffing issues. People have gone on to launch some of our other journals. It's never easy to hire new editors, but she has that done now. So Nature Climate Change will be fully staffed as of the 7th of November, I believe it is. So submit away. They're ready for you now. One reason that I wanted to talk to Bron, though, is just because, you know, we go to a lot of meetings and do a lot of lab visits. And inevitably, people ask us, you know, kind of off to the side usually. They'll say, like, how did you become an editor? You're like, who does this? Why do you do it? How does it work? And a big chunk of the interview is Bron's career arc from being a geoscientist herself and then deciding that it wasn't working long-term. It wasn't what she wanted to do. It was working scientifically for her, but just wasn't where she wanted to go long-term. And she found editing and had a great knack for it. So I hope that people will listen to this and have a better idea of how you might want to get into editing if you have an interest in doing it. I mean, our jobs are posted on Nature's LinkedIn page, are posted in the jobs section of Nature. So I encourage you to check it out. I'm also happy to talk to you about those career options if you have an interest there. And there's also a great feature article on some of the challenges that young scientists are facing a couple weeks ago, I guess it was. And I'll put a link to that on the show notes at forecastpod.org. So hopefully you'll enjoy that. Yeah, this is, again, a little bit off-piste from my usual hardcore physical climate science stuff. I will next time talk to John Foley from the California Academy of Sciences. So that's kind of a combination of museum stuff and geosciences. And I promise, I'm going to interview, I think, an aerosol scientist on November 14th and get back into some really serious climate science. Bronwyn Wake, the chief editor of Nature Climate Change. Bron, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You're Australian. You're from Canberra. You grew up there in this sort of unusual city and stayed on there to do your bachelor's degree at ANU, the Australian National University. What are the highlights of growing up in Canberra? Are there any highlights of growing up in Canberra?
Canberra has a reputation for being a very dull city with lots of roundabouts, but where you grow up is your home. You have your family, you have your friends. And so, like any childhood, there's lots of, you know, great memories associated with Canberra for me. I was there until I was 21, and we actually lived in the same house the whole time. So I knew my neighborhood really well. I had a good set of friends. So just like any childhood, I have lots of fond memories of the place.
When you were a kid, what was your favorite activity?
We were allowed out till kind of sunset, not in the summer, obviously, that was too late. But
yeah,
we grew up in a street where there were lots of kids. So it was a street of about 20 houses and there were lots of kids and it was kind of an open door policy. So you'd be in and out of everyone's house, in their backyards, and you were out until mum came out and yelled for you to come home for dinner. So it was lots of fun just playing with the kids of all different ages in our street.
You have a background that seems sort of perfectly suited to being a editor for one of our journals, which is that you have a degree in chemistry, but you also have a degree in Japanese and Asian studies, which indicates this incredibly broad range of interests. How did you kind of get going on those two pathways and choose to invest the time and energy in double majoring?
So I picked my university degree based on my best subjects in high school. In Australia, it's quite common to learn Japanese. There was a lot of promotion of Japanese as a language due to the tourism and the close connections in the 90s.
Right.
That's how I got into studying Japanese, and I enjoyed it. So when it came to selecting a university degree, I wasn't really sure what to do. I knew I was going to go to university, but I didn't have a clear life plan. And so I pulled together chemistry, which was my top subject, and Japanese, which was my other top subject. And that was a double degree at ANU.
And what's a chemistry degree like for an undergrad in Australia? Do you have any level of specialization, or is it just kind of all aspects of chemistry?
So you can major in, you know, the more inorganic or organic, but you kind of cover most of the topics within the subject area. So I ended up preferring inorganic and physical chemistry. So those are the ones I continued on in my third and fourth year.
It looks like you entered your PhD program, I think, in 2003. You wrapped up your undergraduate in 2001. Did you do a master's in between, or did you take some time off to do something else?
So in Australia, you typically do an honours before your PhD. So an honours is a one-year course, which has some coursework and also a thesis. So I guess it's kind of similar to a master's in some ways. It's not quite the same as an honours degree in other countries.
Right.
So that's how I actually got into environmental, because I finished my double degree in the middle of the year. So I took 4.5 years to do a four-year degree, partly because I didn't know what I was going to do next. So I dropped back to slightly lower course level. And after that, I was just working in a bar. And then I was still living at home. My dad said, you need to get a real job.
What? Working in a bar is a real job?
Well, you know, real job, but my dad kind of thought something different. So I started looking around at different things. So I applied for various things. I applied for some public service jobs in Canberra. I applied for teaching English in Japan. And an ad my dad saw in the paper was for honours in Antarctic studies in Tasmania.
Aha.
So I applied for that as well. And within a week, I got offered a job teaching in Japan and offered the honours in Antarctic studies in Hobart. So I had to make a decision. And I decided I wasn't quite ready to move overseas. So I took the position in Hobart and moved down to Hobart and did the course in Antarctic studies.
Well, at least you did go over the Tasman Strait. So there was, I was down in Hobart, I think, as you know, for this international ice core meeting about a year ago. And it's just an amazing place. I did the combination of the geography, the size of the place, and the culture down there. How did you like being in school in Hobart?
Yeah, Tassie was great to live in. So when I first moved down, I lived with my grandfather and his wife. So I had the luxury of living in their house and still being sort of at home. But I was in this honours course, which had, I think, about 15 people. So in the first 6 months, we had extensive coursework whilst also getting set up for our projects. And so we kind of had a really close-knit group, and we were really into going for hikes and doing activities together. And actually, within the first few weeks of our honours course, they took us down to Bruny Island on a field excursion.
All right, yeah.
We did a hike, we went out on boats, we went and saw the seals, and it was just such a nice introduction to all the amazing things that Tasmania has to offer.
Did you get a chance to go out on a lot of cruises when you were in graduate school?
So during my honours project, I did some work on the estuary, just in the Derwent estuary, and some of that was with the Department of the Environment in Hobart. At the end of my honours, I went as a volunteer on the Aurora Australis on a 76-day voyage, we got ashore for 8 hours in Antarctica. So I was on board as a volunteer, and I was measuring the dissolved oxygen. So that cruise, we sailed from Hobart and we headed towards Mawson Station. So Mawson is in, it's kind of the West Indian sector of Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing a krill survey. So we spent a lot of time going back and forth doing box surveys off the coast there, which is really beautiful because it's known as Iceberg Alley. It's where a lot of icebergs come down into the water. We were doing trawls day and night to measure krill as well as doing CTDs. And then we went into Mawson Station. That was an interesting experience, partly because the ship hadn't been properly prepared for the voyage, partly because it was such a long trip, and also because we left just after New Year's. So we actually did a fuel transfer. So another resupply vessel was in Mawson and tied up in Horseshoe Harbour. So for the first time, two ships were tied up side by side in Horseshoe Harbour, and they did a fuel transfer between the vessels, transferred 200,000 litres of fuel. So that we could complete the whole scientific program of that trip.
Wow.
From Mawson, we then headed up to the Kerguelen Plateau, where we dropped off some moorings. So there were 8 moorings deployed to measure where the currents were flowing around the edge of the plateau. And then we went down into Davis. We picked up the Summerers, sailed across to Mawson, picked up the Summerers, and then headed back to Hobart. So 76 days was a long trip. It's the longest trip I've done. And
yeah, it's incredible.
I'm kind of glad it was my first one. I don't know if I'd sign up for that nowadays. So that was as a volunteer. And then during my PhD, I did another trip on the Aurora Australis out of Fremantle, so from the west coast, and we sailed down I-9 south, so the Clivar line. And that was for my own work. So we were doing samples every half degree. I didn't manage to sample every half degree for myself. I was sampling every 3 stations approximately, and we went down as far as we could into the ice edge. And then from there, we went and picked up those moorings that we dropped off 2 years before. And again, we picked up the Summerers from the bases, but I didn't get ashore on that trip. So I've only been ashore in Antarctica once, although I've been close a couple of times. Other trips that I did is I did a trip on the New Zealand vessel, the Tangaroa, and that was into the Tasman Sea. So sailing in the Tasman Sea is quite calm compared to the Southern Ocean, but we copped the tail end of a cyclone.
Oh my gosh.
It really wasn't that rough. It was completely dissipated by the time it got to us, but a lot of the people on the vessel hadn't sailed anywhere other than calm waters, so they found it quite rough. Whereas I was like, this isn't too bad compared to the Southern Ocean.
I feel like when people have those kinds of field experiences, it tends to either solidify their interest in the field or make them try to get out of the field. But you stayed in the field for at least 5 years or so after you completed your PhD doing postdocs, both in France and at Southampton at the famous institute there. How did you decide to stay in the field, at least for those years? And then what led you to think about doing something else?
So I really enjoyed the research and the field work. Like, to me, a cruise is great fun. You make some really good friends in a short space of time, and they are friends for life. So when I got to the end of my PhD, I wasn't completely sure about staying in research, but I thought I'll give a postdoc a try, you know, and I applied for a position, not actually thinking I would get it. The position I applied for was funded by the EU. It was a EuroOceans postdoc. So that meant it had to be between two institutions. It was to promote collaboration. And so it was between IUEM in Brest and the NOC in Southampton. And so I moved over, and the main part of that project was the Bonus Good Hope cruise. So this was a trip on the French research vessel, the Marion Dufresne, out of Cape Town, sailing across to the zero meridian and down to about 57 south. That was a good experience. It was definitely an interesting experience moving to France, having never studied French and never having visited Europe before.
Not able to use your Japanese there on a daily basis.
I know. This is where I was like, why did I study Japanese? And I ended up on the wrong side of the world. But, and also because I moved over in the summer and my lack of knowledge about Europe meant I showed up and I didn't actually meet my immediate supervisor for the first 3 weeks because, of course, she was off on her summer holidays, which I hadn't realized was such a big part of the French culture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They're gone for the entire month.
And the other thing I realized is, you know, people talk about French bureaucracy, and there were certain elements of that that was quite difficult getting used to. I'd had quite a lot of freedom in Australia. If I needed to order equipment or chemicals, I just spoke to my supervisor and went ahead and did that. When I moved to France, you had to get quotes. You had to get 3 quotes for everything you needed to order, which is quite difficult when you're ordering things for trace metal analysis and there may only be one supplier who actually makes that. So you still have to write off to companies and be like, can I have a quote for this? And they would write back saying, we are unable to quote because we do not have that. But that was part of the requirement. And having to get a French residence permit was another interesting experience.
Talking to a lot of people who have become editors over the year, the common story seems to be something on the vein of they love science, they love a wide range of science, but they're not interested in usually the other things that go along with an academic career in terms of it being all-consuming and having a fairly high amount of, as you just mentioned, bureaucracy and meetings, committees, teachings, things like that. Were those some of your other concerns? What led you into editing in 2012, or was there something else going on?
So I was in France initially, and then I moved to Southampton, and then my postdoc kind of turned into a set of rolling contracts, and I never had a postdoc contract longer than 18 months.
That's very unsettling.
Yeah, so that was one of my concerns, is I couldn't see a permanent job on the immediate horizon, and I had a lot of friends who were within a similar post-PhD period or a few years ahead of me that also were kind of on these rolling postdoc contracts and needing to move quite frequently. So I did have the opportunity for extension of my contract in Southampton, but I'd got to that point, I'd had trouble setting up a method. I was trying to establish a trace metal ICPMS method, and there'd been issues with contamination, various other problems. And I felt like I was really narrowed focus, banging my head against the wall. And I couldn't really see that I would get to that point of having that step back. And as you mentioned, I have quite a diverse range of interests. So I really wanted to have more opportunity to read widely. And I felt I was having to really focus in. And I wanted to try and step back. So I started looking for other positions. Even I thought maybe a slightly different academic position might be enough to stimulate that change. And then I came across editorial. So I came to the Nature Jobs Fair in London and I went to a talk by Richard Van Norden from Nature News, and he was speaking about the news angle. And I didn't think I was quite cut out to be a journalist, but then he spoke about the other roles within the company. And when he started talking about being an editor, that to me was like, this sounds really cool. And I'd actually applied for a job at Nature Geoscience a couple of months previously. I didn't get interviewed. Turns out they wanted a planetary scientist, so I'm not surprised that I didn't get interviewed.
A bit far afield, yeah.
After listening to Richard, I went up and spoke to him after his talk, and he put me in contact with Carl, who's your boss, Mike, as you know, the head of physical sciences at Nature. And Carl generously gave me an hour of his time on the phone. And the more I spoke to him, the more I was like, if this opportunity comes up, I really want to have a go for it. And a few months later, the job at Nature Climate Change came up, and that's how it kind of all happened.
Was that the stage when Nature Climate Change was launching, or had it already been going for a year or so? I can't quite remember.
So I interviewed in November, and the journal had launched in the April of that year. So it was about 6 months old at that stage.
Okay. So were you interviewing with Olive Heffernan, or was Rory already running the journal at that time?
No. So that was at the stage where Rory had just taken over. So Olive had – so Rory had come in when Joe had left, and then Olive was leaving, and Rory had been appointed as chief editor. So he was looking to replace himself in a way, I guess.
Rory Howlett was the second chief editor for Nature Climate Change after Olive Heffernan launched the journal. And Rory was the ecology editor at Nature for 22 years and then was down at Southampton, I suppose, when you must have been there, and then came back to run Nature Climate Change. And Rory was famous for having extremely broad interests and having kind of a lot of enthusiasm for many, many topics. When you were working with Rory, what was your sense of what he wanted to publish and where he wanted to take the journal?
So I first of all have to say, me and Rory were at Southampton at the same time, but I didn't actually know him. And he was working in the press office. So I would see emails with his name, but it never, like I'd never actually met him. I'd probably encountered him in the corridor and not realized. And so a lot of people, when I came up here, they're like, oh, you know each other. I was like, actually, not at all. No, Rory does have really, really broad interests. And I think, you know, that's evident through the pages of the journal. He was quite enthusiastic about a lot of the technological advances, you know, how humankind will counter this, whether it was carbon capture and storage or renewables or technology, those sort of areas. But generally, he just wanted to be publishing the best science that was coming out and making sure we were hitting our remit, which is to cover everything across the natural and the social sciences as best as possible. And it has been a challenge for the journal, being the first Nature journal to branch into the social sciences. But I think over the years, there's been some really nice pieces that have come in. And that's in part due to Rory, also from the groundwork laid early on by Olive, and also the work by Monica, who joined at the journal's launch.
Monica Contestabile, who was now the chief editor for Nature Sustainability.
That's correct.
So, you know, this was a huge change for the overall Nature family of journals to branch out into sociology, and the idea being that there's this enormous amount of work going on in the economics, politics, and psychology of climate change that was, you know, invisible to our readership. And the concern, as you just described, was how are we going to get that community interested in publishing in Nature Climate Change? And now in other journals like Nature Human Behavior and Nature Sustainability, how do you go about, through discussions with, you know, Monica, maybe you've heard, how do you go about cracking into those communities, and what worked well and what didn't work well?
Monica would be the best person to answer this, but I know there was a lot of work involved in just doing visits initially. The journal also had a controlled circulation list. So they had, for the first 2 years, they provided copies free to a list of people. And part of that was to raise awareness of the Nature brand within those fields that we were trying to branch into. There was also an advisory board set up. So whilst the editors make all the final decisions, because it's a new area that the company is moving into, we want to make sure we're doing it right and that we're not going off on our own tangent and not meeting the needs of those research communities. So we have an advisory board of 10 people. That board has been updated over time. So it still has 10 people, but some of those people changed. And they were there to help advise on certain issues within Fields, but also to act as our advocates and go out to those communities and say, hey, this is somewhere you might want to publish and, you know, talk about the benefits of publishing in a cross-disciplinary journal rather than in a specialist journal.
It was a slow burn initially, I think, with the sociology. But, it's really coming online now. So every issue now, there's interesting content in some aspect of economics, policy, or psychology. Is your sense that it's gained sufficient traction now so that the communities, those communities are submitting on a regular basis? Or is it still a matter of really having to work hard to get papers in those fields?
We have traction with some researchers. So I wouldn't say that we're fully reaching into those communities completely. We have got a bit of a toehold in some, but I've been having conversations with the editors who directly work on those communities. And what we want to do is make sure that we're not just publishing our usual suspects. Like, it's great that there's some people who submit to us all the time, but we want to make sure we're getting across the breadth of the research within those areas. And there's some areas that are not as amenable to our format because they're more qualitative, and Nature papers are not really set up to be so discursive. We kind of short and sharp. So we need to make sure that we convey to those communities how their work can fit into our format. And we have to be confident speaking to them that we understand what their needs are as well and whether we need to adapt to address those needs. So I think we're slowly getting there. And it's really exciting that we now have someone who has a psychology, behavioral science background who's now working in the company. And so that will bring another element, because when Monica joined the company, she was the only social scientist for a long time.
Yeah, it must have been kind of lonely at first.
Yeah, so she didn't have anyone to discuss these ideas with, and she was kind of the go-to person for every question that came up within Nature Climate Change, but also across the company.
Oh yeah, I would ask her questions.
So I think it's really good that we're building that base. So, you know, Monica's still with the company, and now, as you mentioned, Nature Human Behaviour. So they're a team of four now, so that's four other people. There's also Alessandro at Nature Energy, so he's an economist. As I mentioned, we have Jen with the psychology background who is working as part of the Social Science Centre of Excellence, and she's working with Nature Climate Change and Nature Energy, and also consulting and advising with some other journals. And we now have a new quantitative social scientist joining us on the 7th of November.
Congratulations. At Nature Climate Change.
Yes, at Nature Climate Change. So we will be back at full staffing, because since I came on board as chief editor, we haven't been fully staffed since May. So it's been a bit of a challenge. But come the 7th of November, we will be at full capacity for the first time in 6 months.
Before you came on as chief editor, you returned to Australia, where you were working half-time as your editorial role, and then half-time doing what are called nature masterclasses for a different part of our country. And it sounds like you did something like, I'm trying to remember, like 25 of these classes, which are 1 or 2 day classes over the course of a year and a half. So you had the chance to talk to an enormous number of people who were interested in submitting to high impact journals, not just the nature journals. From those experiences, what do you think are the kind of the top 1 or 2 things that people struggle with when they're trying to submit to our journals?
Yeah, so I think I did do about 25. I can't remember the exact number. But I met such a diverse range of people, and it was so interesting to speak to all these different people from different subject areas and also at different career stages. One of the most memorable ones was doing a workshop where we had a first or second year PhD student alongside someone who had published close to 500 papers in their research career. But a lot of the time we were speaking to early to mid-career researchers. And I think
postdocs or...
Yeah, or just kind of getting their first permanent position. And I think a lot of the time they're not 100% clear of what the difference is between Nature, the Nature Research Journal, so Nature Climate Change, And now with Nature Communications and Scientific Reports, there's a lot of confusion out there. And I realize I didn't really know when I was a researcher, whereas now it's, you know, to me, it's completely obvious being inside the company. And so a lot of the time it's just communicating what the different journals are looking for and also helping people take that step back from their work and put it into the bigger picture, because so many people are writing up and they're so engrossed that they forget that they're not writing for themselves. They've got to write for their readers. So it's just to help them put it into the bigger context and also to just pause and be like, okay, you're telling me this, but you need three sentences to put it into more context rather than just jumping straight into your results or those sort of things. And I think that's the main thing is people have a lot of questions. People also had a lot of questions about becoming an editor. I think it's an unknown career for many people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really exciting. I got to meet a lot of people and I read research across so many different areas. And it was a good experience for me. It definitely improved my editing and it helped me always think about how I was conveying what I was saying. And we do work with authors when they submit to us at the acceptance stage. We're editing some of their work. But it made me think, how can we, you know, do this earlier on in the process and provide better service to those people submitting to us?
I sometimes wonder when we have a paper come in that is potentially interesting at an editorial level, but is just a bit shambolic in terms of the presentation. Like normally what we do is we would still send that paper out to review. And then if the reviewers are enthusiastic on the technical robustness, then we would work with the authors in the later stages. But, you know, sometimes there's this tension between the level of presentation and the interest. And a couple of times I've sort of rejected it and said, you need to go back and work on the presentation. What's your own personal threshold or what are your ideas about how we could strengthen papers at the initial stage before review?
Yeah, there is that tension there because you don't want to kind of bolster someone's hope and get them to put a lot of effort into reformatting and presenting and then potentially reject the paper after they've put that effort in. So I do agree with you that if the message is clear, then I will probably send those papers to review and, you know, carefully word the letter to the reviewer saying this might not be in correct format, but we want you to comment on the robustness. There is a tension, and I'm not quite sure I know the right answer here because we want everyone's work presented as nicely as possible, but how much time we invest editorially in papers that might make it is a difficult one because we could end up expending a lot of energy and run out of time personally for papers that don't make it. They will probably get published somewhere else eventually, but it's whether as an editor you personally have the time to invest that in the number of papers that cross your desk. And I can't see us having that time. I don't know if you feel that you have time
No. In general, not. Let's go back to the first point you raised, which is just this confusion in the community, totally justifiably, about Nature versus what we call the research journals like Nature Climate Change and Nature Geoscience, Nature Communications, and then Scientific Reports. From your perspective, how do those four kind of categories of journal break down in terms of the broader interest, technical robustness versus technical specificity?
So the first point I want to make is Nature Communications is not that well known to a lot of people. So its name can be slightly misleading. People think it's short communications when actually it can be longer format pieces because it's online only. Nature is very limited for space because it's covering all the scientific subjects. So I see Nature as it's got to be, you know, groundbreaking and it's got to be of interest to a large proportion of the science community. And that's across all those subjects. Whereas when you come into Nature Climate Change, your readership is people interested in climate change. So that might be from the social science side, from the natural science side, and you need to appeal to a proportion of those readers. So it's not as wide as the audience of Nature. And it still needs to be moving the field forward. One thing we are also looking for is papers that are sometimes bringing disciplines together. And so the level of advance might not seem outstanding in any one field, but the advance is that those disciplines are coming together in a unique way for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Nature Communications, I see as being more of interest to people within a field. You don't have to appeal to readers across the scope of the journal because that has the same breadth as Nature. So it's more about those in your immediate field and an advance that's relevant to those readers. And Scientific Reports is for papers that are technically correct. So they're shown to be correct at review, but they might be null results or negative results. It doesn't need to be advancing the field or have that breadth of interest.
I get a lot of questions about nature climate change in terms of your interest in paleo climate papers. And you don't tend to publish a lot in paleo, but you will occasionally. What are your guidelines for what you'll publish in paleo climate?
So we don't receive that many paleo papers. And the scope of the journal and the remit of the journal is it needs to have relevance to current climate change. So if someone sends us a paper that's describing one event in the past and it doesn't have any lessons or implications for current events, then that's something that we can't publish. It's not within scope of the journal. However, if people are showing like a long record and trends and, you know, implying something about how the current shifts are different to trends in the past or, you know, the drivers are operating in the same way or different ways, then that's something we can consider. We have published a couple of nice paleo papers over the years, but there haven't been too many. But it's definitely an area we are interested in as long as it is relating to the current climate change that's happening.
If you think about sort of your daily life as a senior editor before you became the chief editor, which would be the kind of role that most people would have when they are coming into one of our journals as an editor. What's the day-to-day work like, and what is it like over sort of the course of a week or a month in terms of just the amount of hours you're putting into it and the number of papers you tend to be handling?
So you have to remember, I was in Australia for those 18 months before I came chief editor, so that was a very different experience. But if I just focus on when I was working full-time on the journal, I think I was typically getting about 40 to 45 papers a month to handle. On a research journal, everything that appears between the pages comes from that editorial team, the four editors within the journal. So we're writing editorials, we're commissioning and editing opinion pieces, we're handling news and views, and we're writing research highlights and handling all those manuscripts that come in, as well as writing press releases for when those manuscripts are accepted. We also will do things like Twitter and work with our marketing team for Facebook and so on. So day to day, manuscripts are a constant. They're always coming in. You never know when they're going to come in. So you always have to put some time aside for manuscripts. And then we have deadlines throughout the month, different deadlines for different things. And you're working with authors, so you'll set your own deadlines to make sure that you're turning content around when you're editing those opinion pieces to get it back to the authors. So I would say you can have a more structured day than you can in academia. I'd say the hours probably, I'd say I was probably doing about 40 hours a week. You're interacting with different people and you need to meet those deadlines, because if you don't meet those deadlines, you're holding up the production department or the press department. So you have to be good with a lot of constant deadlines. And when you asked me before why editorial, you know, appealed to me, I think I realized I'm not good in academia at setting myself long timelines. If I said I had to write a paper, I'm very good at procrastinating or...
good skills to have, right?
But in editorial, you don't have that luxury. You just have to get on with it, because if you don't meet that deadline, you're holding someone else up. So I've discovered short, constant deadlines actually work for me rather than self-imposed, I need to submit a paper by this date deadlines.
In many ways, the job is kind of the reverse of academia, where in academia, you know, you can take a lot of time to sit back and deliberate and do things over the long time period. But the job is also very consuming of your, or at least for me it was, of your intellectual and energy, weekends, holidays, evenings, and that kind of stuff. Whereas, as you just said, as an editor, you don't have the luxury to let things sit for a long time, because there's this constant churn of submissions. You really have to get things done in a timely fashion. But for me, at least, when I'm done with the job for the day, I can just do whatever else I want. I can disengage from the job and engage with my family or the life I want to have outside of work. Is it the same way for you and your colleagues, or is it any different?
I definitely agree with that. I find it a lot easier to switch off. You might have some things ticking away in the back of your head, but nowhere near as much as in academia, where you're kind of constantly thinking, how can I do that better, or how can I make this work? There are kind of sometimes long-term projects that you set up, and then that might tick away in the back of your head, but there is a lot more of a cutoff. You walk out of the office, you put it down, and then you come back in the next day and start afresh. I definitely see that as having a different balance to academia, whereas, as you said, it's kind of constantly taking up your thoughts.
One thing that I'm often asked about is the degree to which our journals shape fields versus are responsive to fields. And a couple of areas that are in this discussion right now in the past have been the global warming slowdown. So from 1998 to 2012, this reduced rate of warming, which for a while was very controversial, often also called the hiatus. But now also the idea of trying to limit global mean surface temperature warming to 1.5 degrees. And both of these topics, both at Nature and at Nature Climate Change and Geoscience, resulted in a pretty big uptick in submissions on those topics. And across our journals, we published and are publishing a lot on those topics. When you think about how you structure what it is you're going to publish, do you see the journal as being purely responsive to the interests of the community, or do you have larger editorial guidelines or interests that you're trying to pursue with topics like the hiatus or 1.5?
So with the hiatus, there was definitely a surge in submissions. The research kicked up once, you know, the hiatus was kind of formally recognized, and there was a surge in research. And we did publish a number of papers on it, and that's because there was very little known initially. So there was a lot of work coming through that we felt, or I was actually handling those papers, so I felt was really adding to the discussion there. But very quickly, it got to the point where the papers need to be showing more. We can only throw out so many theories before the work needs to provide more concrete evidence. So there was a number of submissions, and then they're still coming in, but we're looking for more significant advances in our understanding of the drivers, the mechanisms, and so on. 1.5, there's not so much research yet, but we've received a lot of proposals for opinion pieces, perspectives, and now the research is just starting to build in that area. So there's a lot of research that's doing the contrast between 1.5 and 2. What does that mean for precipitation? What does that mean for extreme events? Those sort of things. And I think there is value in this research. I think it's important to know. But we also want to know, you know, how realistic these targets are. So that's where the emissions, carbon accounting, and so on is coming into it. So there is some work we're considering there, but we can't consider everything that comes in because we need to keep that balance across all the areas in the journal.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's kind of the tension we have. And I know that you balance this at Nature as well. So we can't just dedicate, you know, 6 months worth of pages to 1.5 or 2 degrees. So we're really trying to extract out what are delivering the key messages to our readers and are going to, you know, spur new research in those areas. So when we're looking at things, you know, we have discussions across the team, and often we'll be more responsive in what we call the front half, the opinion pieces, the reviews and perspectives to some of these topics. And research, we want to make sure we're getting that balance across fields. So we need to be balancing the level of advance, because some fields are moving very quickly. So you need to be getting the papers that are taking the biggest steps in those fields. Other fields, people might only publish, you know, every 1 or 2 years. So you need to be making sure that we're still getting the key papers from those areas coming in. And we're looking to represent all those fields. So it is a balance, and that's where the editors have to be going out and speaking to people, making sure that we're getting people coming to us and that we're getting the balance right and we're not falling too heavily to one side.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking forward, let's say, over the next couple, 3 years, are there particular themes that you're hoping will become more developed at Nature Climate Change, or any directions you're going to take the journal in the coming years?
One thing that I've been quite keen on for a while is making sure that we're getting communities to speak to each other. We do want to be publishing single discipline work that's moving a field forward, but when we can, if we can get stuff that's interdisciplinary, getting people work together, that's going to help move the fields forward. And it was really nice at the recent meeting I was at in China, you know, someone said to me, every time I pick up Nature Climate Change, I want to read most of the articles. And to me, that's really nice. And they said it's put them in contact with people they would never have encountered otherwise. They're not necessarily collaborating with them, but if they're having discussions, then hopefully the way they frame their work and the language they use will make it more accessible to that wider readership in the first place. We want to be breaking down the silos, making sure that we're not promoting one field over the other and trying to get the communities talking to each other, because I think that's the only way a lot of these issues to do with climate change are going to be fully addressed, is if we bring in knowledge from different areas and put those people in the same space. I know that's really difficult, and I know that not every work can do that, but if we can get those people at least thinking about the wider readership and how their work can be communicated to them, then we're going to be breaking down those silos in a small way.
I think that's a fantastic development, because I was just talking to, in a previous podcast, Daniel Aldana Cohen, who's a young sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. And he mentioned that in his own department, there's not a huge amount of support for truly interdisciplinary work, particularly for young scientists who are trying to build their careers for promotion and tenure. But if higher profile journals like Nature Climate Change are really trying and making the effort to publish those papers, then that becomes a mechanism through which that style of work will become more valued in terms of professional evaluations.
No, and that's true. But the other thing is, the peer review process can be quite difficult on those papers.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
So I know we've had this discussion offline, but you have to handle that carefully, because you need to make sure you're inviting people who are open to these ideas, because sometimes they'll just be like I mentioned earlier, we're looking for papers that may not be conceptually a huge advance within a field, but the novelty is bringing the different fields together, getting them communicating to each other. And you have to ask someone not just to judge where the work sits within their own field, but the bringing together of fields. And
that's very hard.
It can be difficult to get the right person. And we don't want to be introducing any bias into that. So you've got to be trying to make sure we're getting a solid peer review without having bias towards individual disciplines or pushing the bias in the other way. So it's a very difficult situation to try and handle.
It's almost impossible. Well, it's very difficult to find reviewers who can simultaneously bring everything together and handle the technical details of the individual subfields that might be in the paper. So I often have the situation where I'll invite somebody to review, you know, one particular part of a paper. Let's just say it's carbon accounting or something like that. And you have to actually write a very careful invitation letter to them saying, look, I want you to be assessing this part of the paper, and I'll have other people looking at these parts as well as a big picture thinker, because otherwise they can be very uncomfortable with even thinking about accepting the review. Do you have that same kind of experience when you're trying to review these big multidisciplinary papers?
Yeah, that definitely happens. And even sometimes if someone says yes, they'll end up reviewing the whole paper and being quite critical of one section where they're not maybe completely qualified to comment on that section. It does provide insight that maybe that section hasn't been explained to make it accessible to the wider readership.
Yeah.
But we need to make sure that we're getting opinions, you know, checking the technical correctness of certain areas and then taking that step back and saying, by bringing these parts together, are we creating a bigger whole?
Absolutely.
It's a balance, but hopefully we're getting there. And now that Nature Climate Change is 5, hopefully we're exposing people to these different areas and people are a bit more open to this.
Bronwyn Wake from Nature Climate Change is working to push interdisciplinary science in the future at the journal. Bron, thanks so much for the chat.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Good to chat to you.
And that was Bronwyn Wake from Nature Climate Change. Bron's been the chief editor there now for a few months and is now fully staffed. Bron, thank you for the chat again. That was great. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, if you like. It's good to subscribe because that way you'll get the shows right away. Otherwise, they can take a few hours to even a couple of days to show up through the ether on iTunes. Also, love to get any kind of feedback you might have, either through comments or reviews on iTunes, or you can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. I'll talk to you soon.